eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another episode of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. It's the Christmas period, and across the Christian world, citizens are celebrating the occasion with Christmas trees and gift giving. Christians, of course, will be commemorating the occasion as the birth of Jesus Christ. However, Jesus and his mother Mary are also beloved figures in the Islamic faith too. So let's take a look at how these beloved historical figures are viewed in the eyes of Islam, starting with Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam.
Christmas is well known as the time which Christians commemorate the birth of Jesus and is a major religious celebration across the world. But what many people don't realize is that Jesus is an important figure in Islam as well, even though Muslims don't celebrate Christmas as a religious holiday. Jesus, Mary, and the angel Gabriel are all prominent characters in the Quran, as are other biblical prophets, including Adam, Noah, Abraham, and Moses. Muslims believe that Jesus, or Isa in Arabic, was a prophet of God, but not God himself. Muslims also believe he was born to a virgin mother and he will return to earth before the day of judgment to restore justice and defeat the Dajjal, also known as the Antichrist. Just as they do with all prophets, including the Prophet Muhammad, devout Muslims give salutations of peace, including to Prophet Jesus. Muslims also believe that Jesus performed miracles, including giving sight to the blind, healing lepers, and breathing life into clay birds. The story of Jesus' birth, as told in the Quran, is also the story of his first miracle, when he spoke as an infant in the cradle and declared himself to be a prophet of God. The Quran also makes clear, Prophet Jesus didn't die on the cross, as Christians believe, and instead was protected by Allah.
And for boasting, we killed the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of Allah. But they neither killed nor crucified him. It was only made to appear so. Even those who argue for his crucifixion are in doubt. They have no knowledge whatsoever, only making assumptions. They certainly did not kill him. Rather, Allah raised him up to himself, and Allah is almighty, all-wise. Everyone of the people of the book will definitely believe in him before his death. And on the day of judgment, Jesus will be a witness against them.
Joining us in the studio today to talk about the personalities of Jesus and Mary, or Prophet Isa and Sayyidina Miriam in Islam, we have two prestigious guests. Father Frank Gelly is an Anglican priest who is the author of a number of books. He has a particular interest in interfaith work and the religion of Islam. And Dr. Rebecca Masterton is a convert from Christianity to Islam and director of the Center of Shia and Cultural Studies. She also has authored the book Shi'i Spirituality for the 21st century. Welcome to the show, both of you. Father, I'm going to come straight to you on this because I wanted to ask you about the fact that, you know, the Prophet Isa is well respected and well beloved in the Islamic faith as well as Christianity. And these are two religions which at times historically have been rivals, if you like. But what's your view and understanding of how Jesus is viewed in Islam?
Well, I like to stress the commonalities, all we have in common. Namely, we have a figure of Isa, Jesus, and the Quran, and the Muslim tradition, is a highly respected, admired figure. And in that sense, there is a correspondence with Christianity. Some people like to stress a polemical aspect different, but that's not my interest, because God has given me a ministry of friendship to Muslims, so I don't engage in disputations, acrimonious dispute. So Jesus is actually a great treasure which we have in common, but also not only from a scriptural, if you like, historical point of view, but right here today. I mean, Jesus was a fighter for justice. He was a radical figure. I always think of Jesus as a radical, and a source of inspiration for us, certainly for Christians today, who liberation theology and so on, who saw Jesus as a champion of freedom and liberation. So in that sense, that's how I look at Jesus. It seems to me that we have so much more in common. Of course, in Islam, Jesus prepares the way for the last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. That's a slightly more polemical difference, but I mean, that's not a problem for me.
Now, Dr. Masterton, obviously, you know, the Christian view on Jesus is quite different in some key aspects compared to the Muslim faith. He's beloved by both, but Muslims see him as not the Son of God, not God himself. That's very important. Now, how did you find, when learning about the Islamic faith, the difference, and which did you find to be sort of more appealing in that sense?
I was raised in a, I would say, nominally Christian household. So went to a church, primary school, but was never really clearly taught Christian doctrine. So I actually didn't really understand the implications of the Trinity or what even the Trinity was. So when I came into Islam, ironically, that's when I started to discover more about the person of Jesus, peace be upon him. And I went back to the Bible because I had never read the Bible growing up, and went back to the Bible and started to discover about what Jesus was talking about in terms of embarking on a spiritual path. That's how I saw it. And so actually, ironically, it wasn't until after I came into Islam that I started to uncover this message from Jesus, peace be upon him, that there is a kind of there's a hidden spiritual path underneath this kind of material way of life that we can be deluded by. So I didn't have really any kind of battle between previous and after converting. It was all quite a smooth transition, really. Yeah.
That is interesting, because Father, I'll come to you on this. With me personally, obviously, you know, there's a kind of divine angle to Jesus from a Christian perspective, and that's something which I was raised on, and there's a great emphasis on that fact, or that point, at least from a Christian perspective. How could you justify that from a Christian perspective? Because obviously Islam's position is that he is a man, after all, and that there is no God but the one God, for example. So how can this be defended, potentially, from a Christian angle?
Well, I don't have to justify it. That's just what we Christians believe. That's our faith, that is our tradition, that's the way we interpret scriptures. But I would like to say that for me...
Not all Christians believe that, though, Father. I know there are some Christian sects that are more similar to the Islamic position on Jesus
Unitarians,
being a prophet.
Unitarians, they're small and insignificant. They're really sort of succumbed to secular, into the spirit of the age. They're dying out, they're not significant. But yes, there was... there were several diatribes, but I want to go back to a question. For me, it is the alliance between our faiths, and especially from the eschatological point of view, with, you know, Al-Akhirah. And when we have, in the Islamic tradition, Imam al-Mahdi, who comes to fight Dajjal, and Jesus comes. Now, in the New Testament, in the letter to the second letter to the two Thessalonians, Jesus is described as slaying a Dajjal-like figure with the breath of his mouth. To me, I say that passage to signify this alliance, which is the key thing, not having a fight over theological nexus. I've written a book about it, actually, Dajjal, the accursed Antichrist. So that is the way I look at it. We could have a big debate about how we justify or explain certain passages, but you know, what worries me, our enemies, our common enemies, want us to have a quarrel, to quarrel between ourselves. We don't have a quarrel because we've got common enemies, the ones we want to fight and oppose.
That is a very good point, very valid point. But I do want to address the issue slightly on the programme, Doctor. The fact is that, you know, Jesus is a man. And I think that one of the things that made sense to me is that You know, we believe that there is one true God, mm-hmm. but that perhaps the Islamic viewpoint that other religions have gone at a slightly different path and have moved away from that initial message. Yeah. I think that's what attracted me personally to Islam the most. Would you agree with that assumption? Do you think that there is an argument to make there that Islam's kind of taking other religions back towards a kind of true initial one understanding of the one true God, and that some Christian beliefs may have deviated a little bit in that sense?
That's the Islamic view, yes. And we know that in some ways Christian doctrines were discussed and hashed out. I mean, that's not really the right way of putting it, but you know, they were kind of discussed and established. The thing is that also I know that nowadays people argue for the separation of religion from politics. I think that's even today is very difficult, and I think that probably what brought about the Christian doctrine of Jesus being the incarnation of God may also have been linked to the politics of the day, you know, the kind of the Roman Empire establishing its influence over its territories. And so when a government adopts certain doctrine, then of course those who have different doctrines become a direct threat to that government. And that may be why they are suppressed. So there were, as you say, many different doctrines. As I understand it, in Arabia, at the time when the Quran was revealed, there were many different Christian groups with at least about three different kinds of doctrines or versions of the Trinity. So it might have been set in stone, you know, by about the 4th, 5th century among some people, but further afield, outside of the Christian centre of power, there were still other kinds of variations of Christian groups. And I think that this is what the Quran addresses, because the Quran obviously addresses Christians, and it says, don't say that, you know, the God is one of three, or that, you know, Jesus is the third of three. Stop saying this, it's not correct. And so we need to look into the history of how this doctrine developed. And I've even from an objective viewpoint, I look at the Quran objectively sometimes. I think it's very, very interesting, the whole kind of theological argument that it's making. It can sound a bit simplistic, that, Islam argues that God is God, and he didn't give birth to a son. He's far above that. You know, he's transcendent above having a son. It sounds very simple. But when you actually reflect upon the subtleties of the Quran, of how it's arguing against the Trinity, and you reflect upon this as a movement that was started, you know, through the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sure, peace be upon him, then it's a very interesting kind of correction, yeah, you could say.
Well, we are going to be discussing more of this, and we're also going to discuss a little bit about the mother of Prophet Isa as well later in the show. So let's move on and have a look at the legacy of this prestigious woman in Islamic history as well as Christian history, with a look at the legacy of Prophet Isa's mother, Sayyidina Miriam, in this next report.
Mary, or Sayyidina Miriam in Arabic, is a central figure of Christianity, the wife of Joseph and the mother of Jesus. She's honored with titles including the Virgin Mother or Queen. However, she's also one of the most honored figures in Islamic theology too, with Muslims viewing her as one of the most righteous women to have lived, as per the Quranic verse.
Then came the time when the angel said, O Mary, behold, Allah has chosen you and made you pure and exalted you above all the women in the world. O Mary, remain devout to your Lord and prostrate yourself in worship and bow with those who bow before him.
Miriam features often and throughout the Quran, with her narrative occurring consistently from the earliest chapters revealed in Mecca to the later verses revealed in Medina. In fact, Miriam is referenced more often in the Quran than the Bible, with an entire chapter of the Quran also dedicated to her name. And similar to Christians, Muslims acknowledge her virgin birth to Prophet Jesus. Unlike Christianity, Sidon and Miriam is not depicted anywhere in statues or paintings, as this is considered disrespectful and blasphemous in Islamic tradition. But she remains a deeply beloved character to all Muslims, with her legacy forever cemented in the Holy Quran and Hadiths, with one saying mentioning the Prophet Muhammad, referring to Maryam as one of the four spiritually perfected women of the world.
Well, there you have it. Father, let me come back to you on this, because again, Mary or Miriam is a very important figure in both Christian and Islamic teachings. Now, perhaps you could just tell me what you make of the Muslim view of Sayyidina Miriam. Is it something which you find quite pleasing to see, the fact that there's so much respect for her?
Yes, I do, because there are more verses concerning Mary in the Quran than there are actually in the New Testament.
That's true.
In terms of number, quantity.
She might even be the only woman mentioned directly in the Quran as well, by name.
I don't know, because you are the expert here.
I looked at Dr. Marston, she agrees with me, so I'll assume that's true.
But, as you mentioned, this, I must make a comment about something Dr. Marston said earlier on about these various sects which are in Saudi Arabia, in the Arabia of the Prophet. There was, you have to be careful here with this group, there was a group called the Ebionites, who were initially Jews, who accepted Jesus, but not as Son of God, only as a Messiah. And there is some scholarship that the Ebionites actually lived on in the Middle East and eventually ended up in Arabia. And according to this view, which obviously Muslims would not agree with, they actually influenced the text of the Quran. Now, but I'm only mentioning this not to agree with it, but to say that there are various ways of looking at this sex and so on. Well, that's coming back to Mary. I pray, one of my regular prayers is Hail Mary. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. So she's part of my spirituality. And I've been to many Mary shrines and everything else. I love a passage in the Quran where she's seeking shelter somewhere in a desert place and under a palm, which gives a shade as well as dates and everything else. It's wonderful because that's a story which also exists in the Christian tradition. Now, when King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia visited Pope Benedict years ago, he brought him a palm and had explained how that, and the Pope said, "Ah, è una bella storia." In Italian, means it's a fine story. So the point is that all this, you know, there's elements linked to faith in it, the things we can want to stress together. And it seems to me there is no contradiction. I know, yes, Mary, you know, but she's giving birth to this child via the Ruh, the Spirit of God. To me, it depends on a different way, to me, that coheres with the Christian account.
Well, Doctor, one thing that I think Islam is basically, one of the issues that Islam faces these days is that it's seen as a religion which is not holding women in high regard, essentially. But actually, when we look at how the Quran emphasizes the importance of female historical characters like the mother of Prophet Jesus, we find that that's not actually the case. Perhaps you could emphasize that point. She's not the only woman in Islam that has this high status as well.
Yes, she's honored in the Quran as, you know, being of a prophetic lineage. And there is a very sympathetic story about her in the Quran. There is a kind of, she's depicted with mercy and, you know, the hard time that she went through conceiving Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, and how she faced the people of her community when they were absolutely scandalized and shocked about this conception. So, and the way she's discussed is, I mean, because the Quran does have a very consistent tone, this is something that I discovered when I was coming into Islam. How the Quran talks about all of these narratives is with this consistent tone. And so in the same way that it talks about prophets is how it talks about Lady Maryam as well. So, and then, of course, she's visited by this spirit from God in the form of a man, and who is going to announce to her that she is going to conceive of Prophet Jesus. So this shows that there is a respect for her and a natural acceptance of her being from a family of honour and being an honourable woman. Yeah. So, and of course, she's given a lot of prominence in the Quran as well.
Now, Father, I'm going to challenge you again on another point, because one area where Muslims would have issue is idols and the concept of setting up statues which could potentially be worshipped in a way. And I think that in some Christian practice, that seems to be the case. I think we can take, for example, what happens during services in Rome, for example. What's your view on that? How could that be justified?
Yes, some Christians, especially Protestant Christians, have disagreed with setting up images and statues. There's a difference. There are images in the flat and statues in the round. But of course, I mean, I don't particularly worship statues. I mean, I don't use statues. But if I had to look at it, I would say these are just foci of spirituality, which are aids to relate into the divine. So when I think of the statue of St. Francis, who's my patron saint, in a church, I'm a Protestant, yeah, I'm supposed not to agree on that kind of stuff. But in the Church of England, we got a halfway house. I'm not saying, what a wonderful statue here. This is God, but this is just an aid to concentrating on what Francis stood for, which was love of the poor, spirituality, miracles, and everything else. So I don't see that as a big problem at all.
Do you think that the Islamic view on this is understandable in the sense that we respect these characters so much that we don't want them to be portrayed in any way, shape or form, because, you know, a statue can over time become sort of ugly looking. It also might encourage people to move away from the worship of the one God towards kind of like a worship of a statue. What's your view on it from a Muslim perspective? Can you understand it? Do you think that it's...
Yes, of course, I do understand it and respect, even to some extent admire the Muslims' idea of complete purity, of God, monotheism, and everything else. But, you know, that polemics in Islam itself. I mean, for example, the tradition, you cannot represent a figure of a prophet. Now, as you know, there are Mughal miniatures as well as Persian miniature, the prophet is shown as even his face is shown. There is a diversity of views.
We don't appear to have much time left of the programme, so I want to ask you straight up, Father Frank. You've written about Islam, you seem to love Islam very, very much, you've learned about the religion so much over the years. Why don't you accept Islam and become a Muslim?
Oh, it's a wonderful question, isn't it? I've got a common friend, a Russian, who asked me the same question. Well, the simple answer is I'm a Christian. I like Islam, and to say to some extent I even admire it, but I'm a Christian. Sometimes if I want to be really wicked, as a terrible joke, I say, well, let's say if you know Saudi prince, a very billionaire, we can discuss it in terms of £100 million. But sorry, that's just a joke. It's not meant to be serious. But as I say, I'm a Christian, and I find in a way that I can help, if I can use the term, our common cause, Islam, more as a Christian, because I'm indicating the way which we have a common battle. If I became a Muslim, I would be just one bloke among many, wouldn't I?
And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But thank you to all of our guests and to you at home as well. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, salamu alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
Recent years, gun violence in America has been one of the most critical challenges facing society. According to a recent analysis, gun-related deaths are the leading cause of death for American children and adolescents. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website of AlertNet writes, the number of children shot and killed in the United States in 2022 exceeded 6,000. The Gun Violence Archive found that at least 6,032 children 17 years of age or younger had been the victims of America's deadly gun epidemic. That was the highest fatality rate since the Gun Violence Archive started keeping a record of gun violence casualties in 2014. The figure reflected a notable increase since last year, when arbitrary deployment of firearms by civilians was found to be responsible for around 5,700 casualties across the country. At least 306 children, 11 years old or younger, have been killed by gunfire, with 668 being injured. Additionally, 1,325 teenagers aged between 12 and 17 died by gunfire, with 3,732 being injured. Recently, the Gun Violence Archive said there had been a total of 609 mass shootings in 2022 in the United States. It is projected to reach around 675 by the end of this year. The grim statistics come after a 3-year-old girl in Kansas City, Missouri, was killed on Christmas Eve in what police suspect was an accidental shooting. The child shooting deaths in 2022 also include 19 students, all 11 years old or younger, killed in a mass shooting on 24th of May at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. One of the youngest victims killed by gunfire this year was a 5-month-old baby who was shot in the head while sitting in a car in Chicago, Illinois, during a 24th of June drive-by shooting incident. The United States has been suffering from an expanding trend of gun violence and episodes of mass shootings. In July, President Joe Biden admitted that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields. In October, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, released data on U.S. firearm deaths last year, counting over 47,000, which is the most in at least 40 years. The U.S. population is growing, but researchers say the rate of gun deaths has been getting worse. America's gun-related homicide and suicide rates both rose 8% last year, hitting unprecedented levels since the early 1990s. The New York Times has also covered this story. The gun death rate for children is nearly 5 in every 100,000. It was flat for more than a decade starting in 2000, and most years fewer than 3 in every 100,000 children were killed by guns. In 2014, the rate began to creep up, and by 2020, guns became the leading killer of American children. According to provisional statistics from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, last year was a particularly violent year. 3,597 children died by gunfire. The death rate from guns was the highest it has been in more than 20 years. While the statistics for this year are incomplete, it is clear that the carnage has not receded. In May of this year, the nation watched as horror unfolded in Uvalde, Texas, yet another school ripped apart by bullets, yet another group of children to mourn. yet another shooting in a long line of school shootings, and though the number of school shootings has recently risen to the highest level on record, the overall picture is so much worse. These shootings account for less than 1% of the total gun deaths suffered by American children. No group of American children has been spared, but some have fared worse than others. Last year, nearly two-thirds of gun deaths involved children, 2,279 were homicides. Since 2018, they have increased by more than 73%. Most homicides involve black children, who make up a small share of all children, but shoulder the burden of gun violence more than any others, a disparity that is growing sharply. The number of children who die by suicide with a gun has also risen to a historical high over the last decade. Last year, suicides made up nearly 30% of child gun deaths, 1,078. Unlike homicides, suicides disproportionately involve white children, mostly teenage boys. A decade ago, the number of white children who killed themselves with a gun totaled around 500 annually. In three of the last 5 years, the figure has surpassed 700. The share of gun suicides for black and Hispanic children has been growing as well. Still, in America, among children who die by gunfire, black and Hispanic children are more likely to be killed by others, and white children are more likely to kill themselves. Gun accidents that kill children have also ticked up in the last decade, though they are relatively uncommon, totaling fewer than 150 in most years. Researchers who study gun violence say that is difficult to explain exactly why gun deaths among children have risen so quickly, but most emphasize that the increased availability of guns, especially handguns, which tend to be used in homicides and suicides, and also tend to be stored less safely than some other types of guns, has most likely played a role. The website of Kaiser Family Foundation has also covered the same story. Firearm injuries and deaths in the United States have increased in recent years and adversely affect many children and adolescents. In 2020, firearms became the leading cause of death among children aged 19 and below, and in the first 6 months of 2022, there were over 300 mass shootings across the United States, including the shooting at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. In addition to physical harm, direct and indirect exposure to gun violence can never negatively affect the mental health and well-being of young people. During the pandemic, firearm-related deaths increased among children, with 7 children per day dying of firearms in 2021. From 2011 to 2021, nearly 18,500 children aged 17 and younger died by firearm. During this period, firearm death rates gradually rose until 2017, then slowed through 2019 before sharply rising in the first 2 years of the pandemic. From 2019 to 2021, the firearm death rate among children increased by 50%. This translates to 7 children per day dying by firearm in 2021. Throughout the past decade, assaults have accounted for at least half of all youth firearm deaths, while suicides by firearm have accounted for at least 3 in 10 of these deaths. The spike in youth firearm deaths during the pandemic have primarily been driven by gun assaults. Firearm-related injuries among children have also increased in recent years from 9.9 per 100,000 population in 2010 to 15.5 per 100,000 population in 2020.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Relations between Russia and the EU has reached its lowest point. That's according to the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The top Russian diplomat says Moscow will not do business as usual with the EU, warning that it would find countries to work with beyond Europe. Lavrov further accused the EU of declaring, quote, a hybrid war on Moscow by unquestioningly following the US. He said Brussels' policies have only hurt the interests and well-being of EU citizens themselves. Lavrov has also accused the US of barring EU nations from conducting dialogue on energy with Moscow. This despite the fact that Russia's supplies of cheap gas to Europe has provided the continent with, quote, unprecedented prosperity for decades. Naturally, there will be no more business as usual with such counterparties. We do not intend either to knock on closed doors or initiate any joint projects. The world is not just the European Union for us, and we have lots of friends and like-minded nations elsewhere. The war between Russia and Ukraine started back in February. Since then, the West, spearheaded by the U.S., have imposed waves of unprecedented economic sanctions on Moscow while supplying large consignments of heavy weaponry to Kiev. The Kremlin has said that the sanctions and the Western military assistance will prolong the war.
Well, last year it was $2.3 billion, and from financial year 2023, we'll put in another $2.3 billion. Some of that is non-military aid. Some of that is, you know, the likes of humanitarian support, such as generators. Some of that is obviously military hardware. Some of it is training. We trained Ukrainians in the UK, and we'll train another 20,000 in the UK. And some of it is effectively backfilling British stocks. So stocks we've given away, we need to replace to make sure our armed forces are up to date and on the forefront of being able to defend ourselves. So that's what makes up the $2.3 billion. We're committed to another $2.3 billion for 2023.
As the war drags on in Ukraine, there are now calls to end the conflict. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has been actively promoting his 10-point peace plan and has discussed it with U.S. President Joe Biden and other Western leaders. The plan calls for restoring Ukraine's territorial integrity, the withdrawal of Russian troops, and the restoration of Ukraine's state borders with Russia. It also calls for the establishment of a special tribunal to prosecute Russian war crimes. But Moscow has rejected a peace plan offered by Ukraine, saying that it must include Kiev's recognition of the four regions annexed by Russia. Lavrov says Kiev's plan for settling the conflict with Moscow is a non-starter. He said by putting forward all sorts of ideas and peace formulas, Zelensky cherishes the illusion that with the help of the West, he will be able to achieve the withdrawal of our troops. Lavrov, however, said that Moscow has not refused to resolve the conflict through negotiations, pointing to the previous rounds of talks with Kiev. Earlier this year, Russia and Ukraine held talks to end the war. The negotiations were reportedly on the verge of success when they were scuttled by Western powers. It is now believed that Western nations are trying to prolong the war in order to weaken Russia.
The number of children shot and killed in the United States in 2022 exceeded 6,000. The Gun Violence Archive found that at least 6,032 children, 17 years of age and younger, had been the victims of America's deadly gun epidemic. The number was the highest since GVA started keeping a record of gun violence casualties in 2014. The figure reflected a notable increase since last year, when arbitrary deployment of firearms by civilians was found to be responsible for around 5,700 casualties across the country. At least 306 children, 11 years old or younger, have been killed by gunfire, with 668 being injured. Additionally, 1,325 teenagers, aged 12 to 17, died by gunfire, with 3,732 being injured. Last month, the GVA said there had been a total of 609 mass shootings in 2022 in the United States so far, putting the country on pace to reach around 675 by the end of the year. The grim statistics come after a 3-year-old girl in Kansas City, Missouri, was killed on Christmas Eve in what police suspect was an accidental shooting. The child shooting deaths in 2022 also include 19 students, all 11 years old or younger, killed in a mass shooting on May 24th at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. One of the youngest victims killed by gunfire this year was a 5-month-old who was shot in the head while sitting in a car in Chicago during a June 24th drive-by shooting. The United States has been suffering from an expanding trend of gun violence and episodes of mass shootings. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden said that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields.
According to new data just released by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, guns are the number one killer of children in the United States of America. The number one killer. More than car accidents, more than cancer. Over the last 2 decades, more school-age children have died from guns than on-duty police officers and active-duty military combined. Think about that. More kids than on-duty cops killed by guns. More kids than soldiers killed by guns. For God's sake, how much more carnage are we willing to accept?
In October, the CDC released data on U.S. firearm deaths last year, counting over 47,000, the most in at least 40 years. The U.S. population is growing, but researchers say the rate of gun deaths has been getting worse too. America's gun-related homicide and suicide rates both rose 8% last year, each hitting unprecedented levels since the early 1990s. In a new study, the researchers examined trends in firearm deaths since 1990. They found gun deaths began to steadily increase in 2005, but the rise accelerated recently with a 20% jump from 2019 to 2021. The researchers counted more than 1.1 million gun deaths over those 32 years. The U.S. is saturated with guns and has become a lot more so over the past decades. As deaths mount from gun-related violence in the U.S., so do the sales of firearms. Data from 2020 shows how gun production has increased nearly threefold over the past 20 years, rising from the manufacture of 3.9 million guns in 2000 to more than 11.3 million in 2020. In addition, powerful lobbying groups, including the National Rifle Association, spent nearly $5 million last year to expand gun rights while limiting curbs on who can have firearms and how they can carry it. Also, gun owners have become less likely to cite hunting or sport as a reason for their ownership, instead pointing to personal security. And despite widespread and vocal public outrage, American support for stricter gun laws in 2020 fell to the lowest level since 2014. According to polling by Gallup, only 52% of Americans surveyed said they wanted stricter gun laws, while 35% said they should remain the same. Over the last 2 decades, there has been a jump in the sale of high-caliber handguns and semi-automatic rifles. Figures from a Swiss-based research project named Small Arms Survey estimate that there were 390 million guns in circulation in 2018 in the U.S. Plus, the U.S. ratio of 120.5 firearms per 100 residents far surpasses that of other countries around the world. Secretary General of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, has slammed the French government's crackdown on protesters, saying Paris is violently silencing the voice of dissent.
France's heavy-handed crackdown on peaceful protesters proved the extent of its disregard for human rights. The French government violently silences the voice of dissent. Double standards vis-à-vis human rights have taken a new turn, or what?
Widespread protests erupted in Paris in the wake of a deadly shooting by a gunman at a Kurdish cultural center and nearby cafe on Friday in a busy part of Paris's 10th district.
If it's possible to enter a cultural center with a gun during the day, it means that there is not enough security. It's the kind of thing you only see in France. In other countries, it's not like that. There is no security.
Police arrested a 69-year-old suspect who the French authorities said had recently been freed from detention while awaiting trial for a saber attack on a migrant camp in the capital a year earlier. The attacker killed three people and injured three others. The suspect confessed to a pathological hatred for foreigners and spent nearly a day in a psychiatric facility before being returned to police custody on Sunday. Judicial officials in France have charged the man with murder and attempted murder because of race, ethnicity, nationality, or religion, as well as for the unauthorized procurement and possession of a weapon. The killings also drew Kurdish groups and their supporters onto the streets of Paris. Brimming with fury, the protesters, holding flags and chanting slogans, became disruptive at one point, broke the street railings, and set bins on fire, which led to clashes with police forces after they used tear gas and water cannons to scatter the indignant demonstrators. Police said there had been 11 arrests. Local media reports as well as witnesses said the French police spared no effort to quash the protests as they resorted to excessive use of force in what was literally construed as a heavy-handed crackdown on dissent. In reaction to the French police crackdown on demonstrators, Iran has urged the French government to respect the rights of protesters. In a statement, Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani urged the French law enforcement forces to exercise self-restraint while dealing with peaceful protesters. Kanani said the French government has a track record of dealing with protesters violently and a background of adopting discriminatory policies toward minorities and migrants. Between November 2018 and January 2019, at least 12 people died during the French security forces' crackdown on the Yellow Vest protests against the living and economic conditions across the European country. Friday's shooting drew Kurdish groups and their supporters onto the streets of the French capital, with some of the protesters waving flags of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which is viewed as a terrorist organization by Turkey and its Western allies. Other protesters chanted anti-Turkey slogans and held banners with mottos accusing Ankara of being a killer state and connected to the shooting.
We're obviously targeted by Turkey, by Erdogan's regime, as was the case on January 9, 2013, during the triple murder of Kurdish activists. So today, there's a second time, a repetition of history. Three people again were killed on the eve of the 10th anniversary, and so we reiterate again that for us, there's no doubt that these are political assassinations orchestrated by Turkey.
The French ambassador was summoned after Ankara said French officials did little to stop the anti-Turkey propaganda promoted by the outlawed PKK militants in Paris. The ministry accused the PKK of spreading false information about Ankara's involvement in the shooting. It said the French government and some of its politicians are being used as a tool in this campaign. The ministry urged French authorities to properly look into the violent crimes committed by the terrorist organization. Over the past years, Turkey's relations with France have been stained by their opposing stances on the war in Syria and a range of other disputes. The PKK militants, designated as terrorists by Turkey, the United States, and European Union, regularly clash with Turkish forces in the Kurdish-dominated southeast of the country, which is attached to northern Iraq. A shaky ceasefire between the PKK and the Turkish government collapsed in July 2015. Attacks on Turkish security forces have soared ever since. More than 40,000 people have been killed during the three-decade conflict between Turkey and the autonomy-seeking militant group. Thousands of Moroccans have staged demonstrations across the North African country to reiterate their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause and voice outrage at the U.S.-sponsored normalization of diplomatic relations with Israel on its second anniversary. People from all strata of society heeded a call by the Moroccan Front in support of Palestine and against normalization, took part in nationwide rallies in almost 30 cities to show solidarity with Palestinians and censure Rabat's normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Protesters converged outside the Parliament of Morocco premises in the capital Rabat, where they chanted slogans in condemnation of denormalization and demanded the reversal of the agreement. The demonstrators waved national Palestinian flags and held up placards that read, "Normalization is treacherous and the struggle will carry on until denormalization is revoked" in Arabic. The participants also set fire to the Israeli flag in front of the legislature's building. The people of Morocco have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the agreement by holding demonstrations and protests. The Moroccan Front in Support of Palestine and Against Normalization said normalization with the regime is passionately opposed by the whole country. On December 2020, Israel and Morocco announced the resumption of diplomatic relations after their suspension in 2000 following the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Intifada. The two agreed to normalize relations by signing a deal brokered by the U.S., making the North African country the fourth Arab state to strike such a deal with the regime. The others were the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. As part of the accord, Washington agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara region, which has been at the center of a dispute with neighboring Algeria. Algiers had condemned the U.S. decision, saying it had no legal effect because it contradicts UN resolutions, especially UN Security Council resolutions on Western Sahara. Morocco and Algeria have long been at odds over the disputed territory of Western Sahara, while Algiers-backed Polisario Front is seeking independence from Rabat's rule. Algeria cut diplomatic ties with Morocco in August 2021, citing hostile acts. Rabat controls over 80% of the territory and is pushing for autonomy under its sovereignty. The Polisario Front, however, wants a UN-sponsored referendum on self-determination. Morocco, like any other Arab country that has recognized Israel, insists it will still work for a two-state solution, but this time by engaging with Israel rather than boycotting it. Morocco clearly decided that developing its economic ties with Israel and winning U.S. recognition of its sovereignty in Western Sahara were too important to pass up. According to an opinion poll conducted by the Arab Barometer, 59% of Moroccans say they are hostile to normalization between Rabat and Tel Aviv. This shows a marked discrepancy between official authorities and Moroccan public opinion. The chasm was further exposed by the rise of several political parties that have accused the Moroccan state of betraying the Palestinian cause and collaborating with Israeli settlers. For example, the Justice and Development Party called for the closure of the Israeli liaison office during the bombing of Gaza last year. The Unified Socialist Party and the Socialist Democratic Vanguard Party showed their opposition to the rapprochement with Israel as well. They called it an illegitimate agreement. With all the opposition and outrage over inking the normalization agreement with Israel, why should Rabat do this? While the normalization was enacted in December 2020, bilateral relations between Morocco and Israel had never fully ceased in the past. In fact, in 2014, hundreds of diplomatic letters leaked by a Moroccan activist revealed that the two had been maintaining an ongoing political dialogue. Similarly, Israeli records reported $37 million in trade with Morocco in 2017, as well as signing of several trade and economic agreements. The diplomatic normalization was simply an opportunity for the kingdom to recognize and strengthen a cooperation that has always existed.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The United States of America is a country that suffers from violence and daily killing of its citizens. But in the last months of this year, 2022, the level of violence and the use of firearms by the American people against each other has reached a peak. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Hill newspaper gives us more detail. According to the non-profit organization Gun Violence Archive, there have been a total of 609 mass shootings in 2022 in the United States so far, putting the country on pace to reach around 675 by the end of this year. Last year saw a shocking 690 mass shootings across the United States, up from 610 in 2020, and 417 mass shootings in 2019. The Gun Violence Archive database researchers said on Wednesday, 23rd of November, the country is three mass shootings away from 2022 being the second highest yearly total since we began tracking data. By Thursday, the country was just two shootings away from that dark milestone. At least five people were killed and a dozen and a half injured in a mass shooting incident at a nightclub in the U.S. city of Colorado Springs recently, and six individuals were shot dead on Wednesday, 23rd of November, at a Walmart superstore in Chesapeake, Virginia. According to the Gun Violence Archive, a total of 39,820 people have so far lost their lives in gun violence incidents in the U.S. this year alone. Over 18,000 of deaths were homicides, while around 21,500 deaths were declared suicides. The Gun Violence Archive researchers said after the Colorado incident, gun